shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. It seems appropriate to start our Labor Day program with a note of appreciation from those few who have benefited from the blood, sweat, and tears of working people, the rich.
Let's be honest. You'll never win the lottery. On the other hand, the chances are pretty good that you'll slave away at some miserable job the rest of your life. That's because you were in all likelihood born into the wrong social class. Let's face it, you're a member of the working caste. Sorry. As a result, you don't have the education, upbringing, connections, manners, appearance, and good taste to ever become one of us. In fact, you'd probably need a book the size of the Yellow Pages to list all the unfair advantages we have over you. That's why we're so relieved to know that you still continue to believe all those silly fairy tales about justice and equal opportunity in America. Of course, in a hierarchical social system like ours, there's never been much room at the top to begin with. Besides, it's already occupied by us. And we like it up here so much that we intend to keep it that way. But at least there's usually someone lower in the social hierarchy you can feel superior to and kick in the teeth once in a while. Even a lonely dishwasher can easily find some poor slob further down in the pecking order to sneer and spit at. So, be thankful for migrant workers, prostitutes, and homeless street people. Always remember that if everyone like you were economically secure and socially privileged like us, there would be no one left to fill all those boring, dangerous, low-paid jobs in our economy, and no one to fight our wars for us or blindly follow orders in our totalitarian corporate institutions, and certainly no one to go meekly to their grave without having lived a full and creative life. So please, keep up the good work. You also probably don't have the same greedy, compulsive drive to possess wealth, power, and prestige that we have. And even though you may sincerely want to change the way you live, you're also afraid of the very change you desire, thus keeping you and others like you in a nervous state of limbo. So you go through life mechanically playing your assigned social role, terrified what others would think should you ever dare to break out of the mold. Naturally, we try to play you off against each other whenever it suits our purposes, high-waged workers against low-waged, unionized against non-unionized, black against white, male against female, American workers against Japanese, against Mexican, against... We continually push your wages down by invoking foreign competition, the law of supply and demand, national security, or the bloated federal deficit. We throw you on the unemployed scrap heap if you step out of line or jeopardize our profits, and to give you an occasional break from the monotony of our daily economic blackmail, we allow you to participate in our stage-managed electoral shell games, better known to you ordinary folks as elections. Happily, you haven't a clue as to what's really happening. Instead, you blame aliens, tree-hugging environmental wackos, niggers, Jew bastards, feminazis, faggots, welfare queens, and countless others for your troubling situation. We're also very pleased that many of you still embrace the work ethic, even though most jobs in our economy degrade the environment, undermine your physical and emotional health, and basically suck your one and only life right out of you. We obviously don't know much about work, but we're sure glad you do. Of course, life could be different, society could be intelligently organized to meet the real needs of the general population. You and others like you could collectively fight to free yourselves from our domination. But you don't know that. In fact, you can't even imagine that another way of life is possible, and that's probably the greatest, most significant achievement of our system, robbing you of your imagination, your creativity, your ability to think and act for yourself. So we truly like to thank you from the bottom of our heartless hearts. Your loyal sacrifice makes possible our corrupt luxury. Your work makes our system work. Thanks so much for knowing your place without even knowing it.
Well, the rich ought to be appreciative they've gotten so much from the rest of us. Next, we'll hear in some detail what they're getting and getting away with, as Professor Michael Parenti speaks on welfare for the wealthy. Also coming up on today's program, we continue with our series of readings on the history of the radical labor movement in America. And then, Professor Howard Zinn will talk on the need for a working class citizen's economic bill of rights. Last but not least, we'll report on some interesting developments on the Frankenfood front.
This is Radio Democracy, a series of 12 commentaries by the noted author and political analyst Michael Parenti. This segment is titled, Welfare for the Wealthy, How Corporations in America Feed Out of the Public Trough While Preaching Virtues of Self-Reliance to the Rest of Us.
Big business is fond of preaching the virtues of self-reliance and individual initiative. Big businessmen are fond of denouncing those who run to the government for handouts. In fact, no interest feeds more lavishly out of the public trough than corporate America. Successive Democratic and Republican administrations have dedicated themselves to supporting the corporate system. They offer an array of subsidies and services to business. They impose a taxation system that shifts costs and diseconomies onto the general public. And they launch military spending programs that have transformed the United States into a permanent war economy. Rather than a laissez-faire government that does little, we have a corporate state that plays an increasingly active role in sustaining the process of capital accumulation. The pattern of using the public's money to bolster the profits of private enterprise is as old as the Republic, but over the decades it's gained a lot of momentum. The federal government leases or sells at a mere fraction of market value billions of dollars worth of oil, coal, and mineral reserves, and grazing and timber lands. In any given year, the government hands out billions to big business in tax exclusions, tax credits, price supports, loan guarantees, payments in kind, export subsidies, subsidized insurance rates, marketing services, irrigation and reclamation programs, and research and development grants. The government pays out billions of dollars in unnecessarily high interest rates. It permits public funds to remain on deposit in banks without collecting interest. It tolerates overcharging by firms with whom it does business. And it provides long-term credits, tariff protections, and reduced tax assessments to large companies. Over $26 billion a year in federal crop subsidies benefit mostly big agribusiness and affluent farmers, with relatively little going to small producers. As of 1993, the federal government was losing up to $52 million a year by charging ranchers below-cost grazing rates on public land. In other words, it cost the government more to maintain the lands than what they were charging the ranchers. At least $97 billion in public subsidies have gone to the nuclear industry, and another $76 billion worth of taxpayers' money has gone to federally funded research and development, and this has passed straight into corporate hands without the government collecting a cent in royalties on sales. Under the Mining Act of 1872, companies mine valuable minerals and metals from public lands without paying royalties. One company is today, in 1994, mining a gold deposit in Nevada with an estimated value of over $7 billion without paying a royalty fee. and with the right under the law to purchase the land for $5 an acre. The U.S. Forest Service continues to open national forests to timber companies at below the cost of running the program for an average yearly government loss of over $31 million. The government directly subsidizes the railroad, airline, and shipping industries. The government subsidizes exporters of iron, steel, textiles, tobacco, paper, and other products. Energy companies have received huge amounts in grants and tax incentives to encourage oil exploration. Billions of dollars go to bail out such giant companies as Chrysler and Lockheed, while small businesses are left to sink or swim on their own. When one of the nation's largest banks, Continental Illinois, was on the brink of failure, it received $7.5 billion in federal aid. Another $8 billion went to the International Monetary Fund to offset the losses incurred by U.S. banks in bad loans to third world nations. No mom-and-pop business is bailed out when they go bankrupt or make a bad investment. Probably the most outrageous case of compensation involved DuPont, Ford, General Motors, and ITT, and it occurred during World War II. These firms owned factories in Nazi Germany that produced tanks, bombers, and synthetic fuels for the Nazi war machine. After the war, rather than being prosecuted for aiding and abetting the enemy, rather than being jailed as traitors, ITT collected $27 million from the U.S. government for war damages inflicted on its German plants by Allied bombings. General Motors received over $33 million for damages to its enemy war plants. No individuals who served in the Army received damages for losing a leg, an arm, a son, or anything else, or a home or property. Under corporate state capitalism, the ordinary citizen pays twice for most things. First, as a taxpayer who provides the subsidies and supports, then as a consumer who pays the high-priced commodities and services. Whole new technologies are developed at public expense. Nuclear energy, electronics, aeronautics, space communications, mineral exploration, computer systems, biomedical genetics, and others, all of them developed almost completely at public expense, only then to be handed over to industry for private gain. Thus, AT&T managed to have the entire satellite communications system put under its control in 1962 after U.S. taxpayers had put up the initial $20 billion to develop it. So the big corporations rely on socialism. It's the socialism for the few. The U.S. taxpayers, the government develops the thing, and then it's handed over to big business to profit off. The U.S. government, through its Agency of International Development, or AID, spent $1 billion in taxpayer money over the last decade to help U.S. companies move U.S. jobs to cheaper labor markets abroad. AID provided low interest loans, tax exemptions, travel and training funds, and advertising funds. AID also provided blacklists to weed out union sympathizers and organizers in various countries. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, the government poured over $500 billion into bailing out the savings and loan associations. Under the deregulated thrift market adopted during the Reagan years, the SNLs could take any investment risk they wanted with depositors' money, often at great profit to themselves. After all, the higher the risk, the higher the return, usually. They do this with the understanding that failures and bad debts would be picked up by the U.S. government, better known as the U.S. taxpayer. In many instances, the heads of thrift industries funneled deposits directly into family accounts, into executive salaries, or into fraudulent deals, sometimes involving organized crime and the CIA. When hundreds of thrifts failed, the government had to compensate depositors. By the way, these depositors, 90% of them held accounts of over $100,000 or more. The Federal Savings and Loan Corporation issued promissory notes to new investors who took over the failed SNLs. Without Congress's approval, the Federal Savings and Loan guaranteed the principal and interest on all loans including many that had been written off as worthless, and this amounted to the biggest bailout and financial scandal in human history. The people who have benefited the least from deregulation are the ones now most burdened by the S&L cleanup, the ones now held responsible for the costs, the ordinary taxpayers. We have Ronald Reagan and George Bush to thank for this, and Bill Clinton has done nothing different about it. The corporate state strives for optimal investment conditions at home and abroad. The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, known as GATT, facilitates international investment mostly in ways desired by the multinational corporations, undermining environmental and public protections and labor standards, and undermining a host of human services. So with the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, which gives a free hand to big corporations in Canada, Mexico, and the United States, in effect enabling multinational capital to invest where wages are at their lowest while paying little or no taxes and undermining labor gains and health, safety, consumer, and environmental protections. In sum, free market advocates who constantly admonish the poor to lift themselves up by their own bootstraps are the first to turn to the government for fat handouts, bailouts, special services, and privilege protections and supports. The free market state uses taxation as well as public spending to redistribute income in an upward direction from the mass of the people who live off wages and salaries to the select few who live off dividends and interest rates and land royalties and rents. Taking into account all taxes on sales, services, and private income at the federal, state, and local levels, as well as Social Security payments, we find that lower-income people pay a higher percentage of their earnings than do upper-income people, while generally getting much less in return. Over the last dozen years or so, the trend has worsened. The wealthiest 1% increased their income by over 85%, while paying 23% less in taxes. In 1992 alone, they raked in more than $71 billion from tax breaks. The rich have grown richer, but their tax rate has declined. The poor have grown poorer, but their taxes have increased. Income from property ownership, from dividends, interest, land royalties, and rents, has risen 3 times faster than income from work, that is, from wages and salaries. And the inequality is greater after taxes than before. The proportion of federal revenues coming from corporate taxes has dropped dramatically from 50% in 1945 to 8% today. In other words, big corporations used to pay half of all federal taxes, and now they pay only 8%. The resultant revenue loss has to be made up somewhere, and it's made up by an increase in taxes on middle and working class earnings. And it's made up also by greater government borrowing. In 1983, a working mother with 3 children and a salary of $10,000 paid more federal taxes than Boeing, General Electric, DuPont, Texaco, and AT&T combined. These companies paid nothing, though they enjoyed combined profits of almost $14 billion. Profits, not income, profits. After the Tax Reform Act of 1986, which was supposed to abolish such corporate freeloading, 16 major firms, including General Motors, IBM, Hewlett-Packard, and Greyhound, still paid no taxes, despite combined profits of almost $10 billion. Instead, they received tax rebates totaling $1.1 billion. Not without cause did the multimillionaire Leona Helmsley say, quote, "We don't pay taxes, only the little people pay taxes. The federal tax code is written to allow the wealthiest interests to enjoy lightly taxed or tax-free income, including tax-free bonds and tailor-made write-offs and exclusions. Companies can deduct for production costs, wages, marketing expenses, advertising, business meals, travel, entertainment, investment incentives, operational losses, bankruptcy, interest payments, and depreciation. American-owned shipping companies incorporated in foreign countries are exempted from U.S. income taxes. By manipulating the prices charged among their own subsidiaries, multinational companies can concentrate profits in countries with lower tax rates and pay almost nothing to the U.S. Treasury. Overseas earnings that are not repatriated are tax-exempted. And oil and mineral royalties that firms pay abroad can be treated as tax credits at home. Every year, over 100 of the largest private utilities collect taxes on their monthly bills to customers. But by taking advantage of write-offs, they are able to pocket most of what they collect. So in other words, that tax you're paying on your utility really ends up as a profit to the private utility owners. In addition, some 338,000 companies are illegally pocketing almost $4 billion a year in Social Security and withholding taxes from their employees' paychecks. They don't send it in. Relatively few of these delinquent firms have been prosecuted. Tax cuts are supposed to spur new investments, but studies show that firms enjoying reduced taxes actually have cut back on jobs. The rate of investment today, now that the rich pay less taxes, is no better, and if anything, more sluggish than in earlier years because of the decline in consumer buying. The additional billions in tax cuts that the rich won under the Reagan administration do not go into new investment, but into higher dividend payments to stockholders. It goes into bigger executive salaries and into luxury consumption and quick profit speculation. So this idea that if you give the rich a lot of breaks and taxes, they'll have more money, and with that more money, they'll invest, and with those investments, they'll create more jobs, and it'll all trickle down to us, is really not true. Those additional billions, they pocketed, or they used in speculation or in self-indulgence. Creating a super-rich class does not bring prosperity. Numerous third-world nations have extremely wealthy classes that live lavishly off the backs of the common people. In countries like El Salvador, in Haiti, in Mexico, in Argentina, in Zaire, there are ruling classes that are filthy rich, fabulously rich. And this does not bring a general trickle-down prosperity to other people. In contrast, social democracies like Sweden and Denmark tax their rich companies and wealthy individuals heavily, enabling their citizens to enjoy a higher and more equitable standard of living than do third world peoples, higher and more equitable than do Americans. It has been argued that taxing the wealthy more heavily would not make any appreciable difference in federal revenue, since they are relatively few in number. In fact, if rich individuals and top corporations paid a graduated progressive tax of 70% with no loopholes or major deductions, hundreds of billions of dollars would be collected yearly and there would be no federal deficit. Just the deductions that corporations claim for the interest on their business loans costs the government nearly $100 billion a year in lost revenue. In the early 1980s, a 39% reduction in the top tax rate benefiting the richest 1% caused an annual revenue loss of at least $70 billion. These are not trifling sums. There are several ways people can be taxed. First, there's the progressive income tax. This imposes a substantially higher effective tax rate on the rich than the poor. Thus, in 1980, the very richest paid 70% in income tax and the poorest only 18%. I mean, that's really an exaggeration because the 70% tax rate was not quite as severe as it sounds. It did not apply to the entire income. The tax was graduated so that the very rich paid the highest rates only on those portions of their income that went far above middle brackets. The lower portions of their income, they paid the same tax rate as a poor person. The assumption made with a progressive income tax is that the burden should fall most heavily on those who live the most privileged lives, who have an abundance of surplus funds beyond what is needed for necessities. Next is what's called a proportionate income tax, or flat tax. This imposes the same rate on everyone, regardless of ability to pay. Thus, if both rich and poor pay, say, 20% of their income, then a person who earns $10,000 pays $2,000 in taxes and has only $8,000 to live on, while one who receives $1 million pays $200,000 but still has $800,000 to spend. Those who advocate a progressive tax consider the flat tax to be unfair, for while everyone is paying the same rate and the richer person is paying more dollars, the poorer person will have a harder time of it. It's cutting into the bone, not into his fat, because he has very little fat to go on. A dollar taken from someone of modest means has a greater deprivation impact than a dollar taken from the very affluent. Finally, there is what's called regressive tax. It's even more unfair than a flat tax, for it imposes a higher effective rate upon those who have the least. Instead of paying the same rate as in a flat tax, rich and poor pay the same actual amount in actual dollars as for instance, with a sales tax. When both a janitor and a top executive pay the exact same amount of sales tax on a gallon of gas, the janitor is sacrificing a far greater portion of income than the executive. Sales, excise, and Social Security taxes are regressive. Given the many tax loopholes that have been available to rich persons and corporations, the progressive income tax has proved to be not all that progressive. Under the Reagan administration, the progressive tax was practically abolished. It was reduced from 70% top bracket to 28%. Today, the federal income tax is close to a flat tax in its rates, and it's really a regressive tax in effect because it still allows many write-offs for business and big earners, taking proportionately less from the very rich than from the rest of us. After all, John Q. Public, or the average blue-collar worker, has very few tax write-offs that he could claim. The unjustly regressive nature of our tax system is even more evident at the state and local levels. In 45 of 50 states, the poorest 20% of the population pay higher state and local taxes than the richest 1%. Taking all the above into consideration, it is no wonder a retired Internal Revenue Service employee wrote that he and his colleagues were convinced that the nation's tax laws are, quote, largely legalized deceptions that encourage wealthy individuals and corporations to escape with little or no tax payment, while the middle class and the poor pay punitive taxes to make up the deficiency. When government expends more than it collects in revenues, this is known as deficit spending. To meet its yearly deficits, the government borrows from wealthy individuals and financial institutions in the United States and abroad. In other words, they borrow on the future earnings of the U.S. people. The yearly accumulation of these budget deficits is what is known as the national debt. By 1940, given the deficit spending of the New Deal, the national debt had grown to $43 billion. The cost of World War II brought it to $259 billion. By 1980, it had climbed to $908 billion. After Reagan was in 8 years, the national debt tripled to $2.7 trillion. In 4 years under the Bush administration, the national debt almost doubled to $4.5 trillion. So the rate of accumulation is going greater and greater at a higher rate. And Republican administrations bring out budgets which have deficits that are every bit as big and often bigger than Democratic administrations. So the growth in deficit spending has several causes. First, there's the billions in lost revenue because of the tax cuts we were just talking about a minute ago. The government is now borrowing furiously from the same people it should be taxing, the rich moneyed interests. Second, in 8 years, Reagan spent almost $2.5 trillion on the military, and these allocations had a budget-busting impact. Third, the national debt itself contributes to debt accumulation. Growing at an increasing rate, it becomes so huge that the interest paid on the debt has been expanding than the economy and has been expanding twice as fast as the budget. Every year, a higher portion of debt payment is for interest alone, with less and less for retiring the principal. By 1990, over 80% of all government borrowing went to pay for interest on money previously borrowed. Thus, the debt becomes its own self-feeding force. The interest paid on the federal debt every year is the second largest item in the discretionary budget after military spending. Who gets the hundreds of billions in yearly interest on the bonds that the government sells, the treasury bonds, to float their debt? The individual investment firms, banks, and foreign investors with money enough to buy them. Who pays for all this? Ordinary working people who contribute most of the taxes. Interest payments on the federal debt constitute an upward redistribution of wealth from those who work to those who live off personal wealth, which is why conservatives like Ronald Reagan were not too worried about a big debt. Moneyed creditors lend their surplus capital to the U.S. government and watch it grow risk-free at public expense, backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government, just as the framers of the Constitution intended. We and our children will be paying increasingly larger sums to service this astronomical debt. As Karl Marx wrote 150 years ago, quote, "The only part of the so-called national wealth that actually enters into collective possessions of modern peoples is their national debt," unquote. They may take our land, our timber, and everything else. They may take our airwaves. They may take the treasures of mineral deposits in the ground, but they'll never take from us our national debt. That will always be ours.
You heard Welfare for the Wealthy, Part 3 in a 12-part series of commentaries by Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is the author of many books, among them Democracy for the Few, Inventing Reality, Against Empire, and Dirty Truths.
Which side are you on? 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 Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell, of how a good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Daddy was a miner, and I'm a miner's son, and I'll stick with the union till every battle's won.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests. I'm Chris Sturr. Next, we're going to continue our reading of Daniel Fussfeld's book, The Rise and Repression of Radical Labor, which is a history of the labor movement in the United States from 1877 to 1918. Last week, we read the prologue in which Fussfeld sets the agenda for his study, which is to counter the orthodox view among establishment historians that workers in the U.S. freely chose quote-unquote job consciousness rather than class consciousness, and freely chose to work within the capitalist economic order rather than pursuing radical unionism, which challenged that economic order. Fussfeld's project is to document the history of the repression of radical labor, which indicates that the choice of business unionism over radical unionism was anything but free. Last week, we also read the book's first act, which recounts the events of the first mass strike in the United States in 1877, the reformation of the state militias, which eventually became the National Guard, to break up strikes, the formation of the first mass labor organization in the United States, the Knights of Labor, conflicts between the Knights and the more traditional craft unions, and finally, the events surrounding the Haymarket Uprising, massacre, and subsequent trials. This week, we will read Act Two, which covers the further developments of the mass-oriented labor movement in the form of industrial unions in the basic industries of steel, railroads, and mining. As we will see, the years between 1887 and 1902 saw a split both in the working class and in business. The labor movement divided into a conservative faction, which favored collective bargaining within the current economic order, and a radical faction, which favored changing that economic order. Business was divided between union busters and strikebreakers on the one hand, and the emerging corporate liberals who favored collective bargaining with unions, the conservative unions, of course, in order to maintain industrial peace.
Which side are you on? Tell me, which side are you on?
Act 2, Labor and Business Strategies, 1887 to 1902. A wave of repression and reaction swept the United States after Haymarket. Fanned by newspaper editorials that promised a wave of destruction and violence unless anarchism was stamped out, public opinion was whipped up to support the Haymarket trial and the conviction of the defendants. Federal and state governments took no further action, but in many communities in all parts of the country, the local police raided the offices of radical groups and labor unions and arrested their leadership, many of whom were jailed. Meetings of radical groups and unions, especially those meetings designed to assist the Haymarket defendants, were broken up by local vigilantes, often with assistance or benign indifference on the part of local police or sheriff's deputies. Print shops for radical publications were wrecked, and offices of the publications themselves were raided. Much of this agitation seemed to have originated among local business or real estate interests, and in some instances, racist or anti-immigrant agitation was involved. These were tactics that were to be perfected over the next 30 years and adopted in less violent form and with legal sanctions by the federal government in 1918 to 1920. The Knights of Labor, which by now was identified in the public mind with mass action by workers, was destroyed in the reaction to Haymarket, although poor leadership and a series of unsuccessful strikes in 1886 and 1887 contributed to the organization's decline. Its membership fell from over 750,000 in 1886 to probably less than 100,000 in 1890. Most of the unskilled members had quit by the end of 1887. Whatever else may be said about Haymarket, it was instrumental in destroying the first effort to develop a class-conscious program of action out of the mass discontent of the 1877 riots. A mass-oriented labor movement did not disappear, however, but was found in a group of industrial unions that appeared in the 1890s. These were unions that sought to organize all workers in an industry, regardless of craft or skill level, a compromise between the one big union pattern of the Knights and the craft exclusiveness of the new AFL. The industrial unions of the 90s appeared in the new industries of the post-Civil War industrial era. Railroads, steel, coal mining, and non-ferrous metal mining. Large corporations had developed in these industries, and all were dominated either by leading entrepreneurs like Andrew Carnegie in steel, or by investment bankers and other financial interests in New York and Boston, like J.P. Morgan and Company. Except for the railroad brotherhoods, most of the craft unions, particularly the strong ones, were found in industries of a different sort, the relatively labor-intensive, more competitive and less concentrated sectors of the economy, such as cigar manufacturing, construction, and printing. These unions were no threat to the management or financiers of the giant firms in the basic industries. But the new industrial unions were a threat to those interests. They confronted the dynamic leading edge of industrial capitalism, and a series of bitter struggles ensued. The industrial union in the growing steel industry was destroyed by a union-busting corporation. The Amalgamated Association of Iron and Steel Workers was a militant, mass-oriented union. A strong thread of class consciousness ran through its policy statements, but it did not have a socialist program. It was the largest and strongest union in the country in 1892, with over 24,000 members, when the Great Strike at Homestead began. This strike was brought on by the Carnegie Steel Company's decision to break the union and move away from an earlier policy of union management negotiation that had prevailed since the 1880s. The union was apparently taken by surprise by the company's strategy when it struck in 1892. A force of strikebreakers was hired by the company and moved by barge to the steel plant at Homestead, Pennsylvania. Strikers were waiting for them. An armed battle followed, in which the company's forces were prevented from landing and 12 people were killed. This was the only violence, but a week later the state militia moved in. In the meantime, the strike had spread to other Carnegie plants, and injunctions against the union were issued in local courts to protect the company's use of strikebreakers. The strike was a failure, and 6 months later the workers were back at work without a union organization. One of the nation's giant corporations, using strikebreakers and backed by the courts and state government, had destroyed one of the early industrial unions. The Western Federation of Miners was radicalized by class warfare. It was organized in 1893 as a union of all employees in the metal mining industry of the western states, following an unsuccessful strike at Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, in 1892. Starting out as an essentially job-conscious industrial union, interested primarily in wages, hours, and working conditions, it faced harassment similar to that which broke the iron and steel workers: refusal to bargain, strike breakers, injunctions, use of militia, and vigilante mobs. But this union did not fold. Rather, its rank-and-file membership and leadership were radicalized by a series of confrontations with management throughout the 1890s. These confrontations quickly turned into class warfare. The corporations blacklisted union members and brought in strikebreakers and armed private armies. They were supported by local governments and courts, and by the local press and business interests. Where necessary, state governments were called upon for National Guard units, and state courts for injunctions to legalize police action against WFM organizers and strikes. The miners responded in kind, of course, and armed battles, destruction of company property, and forced expulsions of either miners or strikebreakers, depending on which side won the battle, were common occurrences in mining area conflicts. The mining areas were polarized into class-conscious warring groups. The WFM, weakened by loss of membership, was reduced to a hard core of activist radicals. The leadership of the WFM, furthermore, developed a socialist, class-conscious ideology and moved in the late 1890s to form a national mass-oriented radical labor organization. A third industrial union, the American Railway Union, was suppressed by government and the courts. After a strike of railway switchmen in 1892 failed because of a lack of cooperation among the craft-oriented railway brotherhood, Eugene V. Debs left his position as secretary-treasurer of the Brotherhood of Railway Firemen to organize the American Railway Union as an industrial union of all railway workers. The brotherhoods opposed the new organization. Then came the Pullman strike. In May 1894, workers at the Pullman Palace Car Company at Pullman, Illinois, then a company town but now part of the city of Chicago, struck after layoffs and pay cuts. The company refused to bargain. The ARU accepted the Pullman workers as members at its Chicago convention in June, and when the company continued its refusal to bargain, ordered its members to refuse to move trains with Pullman cars attached. There was burning and looting in some Chicago railroad yards. Railroads refused to detach Pullman cars from trains carrying mail, and the press cried out about holding up the U.S. mails. A federal court injunction was directed against the ARU and its leaders. Debs and other leaders ignored the injunction and were indicted and arrested. When Governor Altgeld refused to call out the state militia, President Cleveland sent in army troops to enable the railroads to keep the trains running with the assistance of strikebreakers. These were tense times. The nation was gripped by the worst depression in its history. Coxey's Army of the Unemployed was marching on Washington, and fear of insurrection was widespread. Debs appealed to the AFL for a general strike of all unions. But this effort to widen the dispute into an acknowledged mass strike of worker against capitalist failed. A conference of the AFL unions in Chicago decided that a general strike would be, quote, unwise and disastrous, end quote. The strike was broken by the combination of corporations, courts, and federal government. Debs was jailed, and the union disintegrated. But Debs emerged from prison a convinced socialist, led in organizing the Socialist Party, and became the foremost socialist leader of his time. The fourth important industrial union of the 1890s, the United Mine Workers, moved toward collective bargaining of the AFL type. This union was originally for coal miners only, but in 1898 it opened its membership to all employees of coal mining companies. The broader base of the industry enabled it to achieve some important but limited successes in the bituminous coal mining sector of the industry, largely because here it faced a large number of relatively small firms rather than a few giant corporations like those the Iron and Steel Workers and American Railway Union had to deal with. But in 1902, during a titanic struggle with the highly concentrated anthracite mining part of the company, the UMW opted for business unionism and collective bargaining rather than class action. In the next section of this book, we shall examine the 1902 anthracite mining strike in some detail, for in that struggle, the first political and ideological alignments that ultimately led to a national labor policy of collective bargaining within the existing economic order were forged. During the 1890s, then, American workers tried to build industrial rather than craft unions in the basic industries of the country, steel, railroads, coal mining, and metal mining, contesting with some of the new giant corporations of the era and with the new centers of financial control. The result of the struggle was destruction of all union organization in steel, elimination of the industrial union in railroads, leaving a group of craft unions, the triumph of job-conscious unionism in coal, and the rise of class-conscious unionism in non-ferrous metals. Homestead and Pullman showed that the large enterprises and financial giants of the time would not tolerate mass organization of workers. The instruments used to fight class organizations of working people were brought to a higher degree of effectiveness, the mass media to arouse public opinion, the courts to provide a legal basis for the use of force, strikebreakers to keep operations going and for use as private armies, and jail for the leaders of the workers. All of this was done under the protective umbrella of an appeal to law and order, the sanctity of private property and the United States Constitution, and quote-unquote Americanism. Nevertheless, the seeds of a new growth of radical class-conscious unionism were sown in Western mining areas. Meanwhile, socialists sought to gain control of the American Federation of Labor. In 1890, the Socialist Labor Party attempted to gain admittance to the Federation as a bona fide labor organization, but was turned down. In the next 3 years, socialist elements in the member unions of the Federation gained strength, and in 1893 almost succeeded in getting the National Convention of the Federation to endorse a series of socialist resolutions. One clearly defined issue in the struggle was the socialists' stated goal of using labor unions to arouse the class consciousness of working people. They argued that class action was necessary if workers were to make significant and permanent economic gains. But Samuel Gompers, president of the Federation, argued that workers should seek acceptance of unions as the equal of management rather than displacement of management and the private enterprise economy. In a very close vote, Gompers' quote-unquote pure and simple unionism won out. In the 1894 convention, Gompers used a procedural maneuver to defeat endorsement of socialism, but the socialist element took revenge by defeating him for the presidency of the Federation, throwing the election to John McBride of the United Mine Workers. But Gompers was re-elected the following year and continued his now bitter struggle against socialists within the Federation. Daniel DeLeon, who had been one of the leaders in the effort to commit the Federation to socialism, gave up that battle and organized an openly socialist union, the Socialist Trades and Labor Alliance, but it made little headway against the Federation and never achieved a significant size. Gompers' victory enabled him to say in 1900 that there was no place in American unions for, quote, socialists and anarchists, end quote. Another attempt to offer an alternative to the AFL and to develop a class-conscious and united working class was made by the Western Labor Union, organized in 1898 by the leaders of the Western Federation of Miners. The WLU differed from Gompers and the AFL on a number of crucial points. It wanted to organize all workers. It de-emphasized craft exclusiveness by advocating free transfer from one union to another. It opposed restrictions on immigration, except Asians. And it advocated strong political action by workers as a class. And as the class war in the West accelerated in the last years of the 19th century, the WLU leadership became more vocal in its denunciation of capitalism and the national government that treated the repressive violence used against Western labor with benign neglect. A clash between the WLU and the AFL developed almost immediately. By 1900, several unions west of the Mississippi had affiliated with the WLU and rejected an AFL ultimatum to return to the Federation. The AFL then started sending organizers into the western parts of the country, which it had largely ignored until then. In response, the WLU was transformed into a national organization, the American Labor Union, which sought to become a radical organization in opposition to the AFL. The ALU proposed a syndicalist form of socialism, direct ownership and management of enterprise by workers. It favored industrial rather than craft unions, class solidarity of all workers, and vigorous economic action, strike, and boycotts by the working class as a whole. Here was a further development of the mass movement of 1877 and the ideas of the Knights of Labor, sharpened by the labor conflicts of the 1890s, that was to lead directly into the industrial workers of the world a few years later. At the time, however, the ALU made little progress against the entrenched AFL. It remained almost wholly an adjunct of the Western Federation of Miners. Political action was an alternative to economic action, and that path was also explored. When Debs left prison after the Pullman strike, committed to socialism, he moved into politics, organizing the Social Democracy of America to seek a socialist society through the democratic political process. Debs was successful in attracting a wide variety of socialists to the new party, including some Orthodox Marxist members of De Leon's Socialist Labor Party, socialist elements from the populists, and remnants of the largely middle-class Nationalist Party that had been inspired by Edward Bellamy's utopian novel of 1888, Looking Backward. With more and more socialist groups attracted to Debs's leadership, there was a merger of socialist political organizations in 1901 to form the Socialist Party of America. Among organized groups, only De Leon's Socialist Labor Party remained independent. Despite this growing political unity on the left, there was no viable left-oriented organization within the working class itself. The Knights of Labor had been destroyed in the aftermath of Haymarket. Industrial unions made little headway against the combined opposition of corporations, courts, and governments. Craft unions and the AFL remained committed to collective bargaining within the framework of a private enterprise economy, still controlled by the more conservative elements of the labor movement, who had no intention of mounting a challenge to the capitalist economic system. Conservative elements in the labor movement found allies among more liberal elements in the corporate community. These groups found a common ground in the trade agreements movement of the 1890s. In a number of industries, associations of employers were organized to bargain with labor unions in order to reach agreement on wages, hours, working conditions, and other labor matters. The agreements were for specific periods of time, usually 1 to 3 years, and could be national, regional, or local in scope. Crucially, they required acceptance of the union as a representative of the workers. On the one hand, the employers acquiesced in varying degrees to control of access to the job by the union, although the closed shop was seldom included in the agreement. The unions, in turn, gave up the right to strike for the duration of the agreement. There was some doubt that these trade agreements were enforceable in the courts, but opinion among both employers and union officials was that they involved a strong moral commitment on both sides. The growth and limited success of the trade agreements movement strengthened the position of relatively conservative labor leaders like Samuel Gompers, John Mitchell of the Mine Workers, and others who opposed the socialists. They could point to growing acceptance of unions by employers and concrete economic gains for workers. A middle position was emerging between the socialist ideology of left-oriented workers and the union-busting philosophy that prevailed at Homestead and Pullman. Even among the leaders of large corporations, there were some who were willing to accept labor unions as one means of achieving industrial peace. The chief spokesman for this group of corporate liberals was Marcus A. Hanna, U.S. Senator from Ohio, who had built a large Midwest coal, iron, and lake shipping enterprise and had become an important Republican political entrepreneur as well. He was a major fundraiser for the Republican Party, managed William McKinley's campaign for the presidency, and became Republican National Chairman. He was one of the first to see that the new giant corporations needed labor peace in order to protect the security of their large investments, that this security was best achieved by settling labor disputes in a manner acceptable to workers, and that labor unions were the natural spokesman for workers. He wanted to avoid the threat of socialism by providing for peaceful settlement of labor management disputes. In Hanna's own words, in a speech advocating industrial reconciliation and arbitration, quote, "The large aggregations of capital feared at first by labor may prove to be labor's best friend, in that, control of a trade being thus centralized, there is opportunity to establish friendly relations which shall make uniform conditions throughout the country, or large sections thereof, and reduce the basis of competition to the quality of the product rather than to the concessions forced from labor. The great productive capacity of this country has forced upon us the aggregation of capital and the creation of great material wealth seeking opportunity for investment. This rapidly increasing wealth must find investment, and to make the investment in industrials secure, we must have industrial peace. The trusts have come to stay. Organized labor and organized capital are but forward steps in the great industrial evolution that is taking place. You are well aware that there has been a tendency in this country, from the very nature of things, to what is called socialism. Everything that is American is primarily opposed to socialism. There is nothing in the organization of society in this country that can afford to permit the growth of socialistic ideas. They are un-American and unnatural to us as a people." End quote. Hanna was no visionary. He was a pragmatist. Collective bargaining between labor and management was seen as the way to preserve private enterprise. The National Civic Federation was born out of the trade agreements movement and the philosophy of corporate liberalism. Organized in 1900, it had its origins in the Chicago Civic Federation that had been organized by journalist Ralph Easley in 1894 to try to end the Pullman strike through mediation and conciliation. Failing in that attempt, Easley and his new group addressed a variety of local issues, gaining the support of much of the Chicago business leadership for civic reform. One of the organization's continuing interests was arbitration and conciliation in labor disputes. Starting in 1898, the Chicago organization sponsored a series of national conferences on political reform, foreign policy, and big business, all oriented toward reform along the lines of the progressive movement and organized around a pluralist philosophy representing business, labor, public, and other interest groups. These activities culminated in the formation of the National Civic Federation in 1900. Although Easley was the secretary and organizer, Mark Hanna was president of the new organization, and Samuel Gompers was first vice president. This combination symbolized the approach of the NCF: reformer publicist, corporate liberal, and labor conservative. Other well-known people who were active in the NCF included Oscar Straus, later Secretary of Commerce and Labor in Theodore Roosevelt's cabinet, August Belmont, New York financier, Seth Lowe, reform mayor of New York City and president of Columbia University, and John Mitchell, president of the United Mine Workers. Important businessmen, labor leaders, and political figures united in an organization that sought peaceful settlement of the conflict between capital and labor based on acceptance of union organization by business and of private enterprise by unions. In the 1890s, then, both workers and business interests divided. The radicals among workers had seen their economic organizations shattered and responded by moving toward political organizations. The union movement was dominated by conservative leaders like Gompers and Mitchell, who opposed radical change and political action and favored immediate economic gains within the existing economic order through collective bargaining. The business community was also dividing into liberal and conservative groups. the liberals were willing to work with conservative union leaders for labor peace through collective bargaining and a share of the pie for workers. The business conservatives remained adamantly opposed to union organization and collective bargaining, but as yet this group had no organization to act as its publicist and political arm. Yet, a contest was building that offered either class conflict or a compromise based on the coalition of labor conservatives and corporate liberals. As we shall see, the resolution of this contest depended on which side was able to use the power of the state. Ultimately, it was liberal control of the national government that brought victory to the philosophy of collective bargaining and repression of radical labor.
Tell me, which side are you on? 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 Don't scab for the bosses. Don't listen to their lies. Us poor folks haven't got a chance unless we organize.
That was Act 2 of The Rise and Repression of Radical Labor. In next week's show, we will continue with Act 3, which takes an in-depth look at the anthracite coal strike of 1902. The song accompanying this segment has been Which Side Are You On?, sung by the Weavers.
Which side are you on? Which side?